I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson. In a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick, Galen, Arlen, Bo, Geekadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan, David,
Ava, Bob, The West Bank Robbery Podcast, Jamie,
Gary, Ishtafer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Ryan,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show. Welcome back to Parallax Views, a guest that we've been having on a lot. He is very useful when it comes to looking at issues involving the Middle East, the Gulf states, and right now what's happening in Gaza and the implications geopolitically. James M. Dorsey of The Turbulent World with James M. Dorsey. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well, but, you know, as I've been saying the past month, it's very difficult times for a lot of us because we have contacts in Gaza or the West Bank or Israel even proper. And I think tensions are very high right now. Emotions are very high. What's your analysis, though, of what has transpired since we last spoke? We spoke, I think, on October 7th or 8th. What's your analysis of what has happened in the past month?
Well, I think what we're seeing is essentially that clearly there's an international consensus in the international community, with a few exceptions, in terms of demanding a ceasefire, something that Israel rejects. But we are seeing increased criticism of Israel by its most staunchest allies, the United States and various European countries. I think what we're also seeing is a tug of war, if you wish, in terms of the day after, whereby everyone, I think without exception, including the United States, does not want to see an Israeli presence in Gaza. And yet that is exactly, in whatever form or fashion, that is exactly what the Israelis are demanding. And of course, then there's a third issue, which is the backroom negotiations to try and get at least some of the hostages released.
If you could, with regards to the day after scenario, I'm having multiple guests on to talk about this. I've had a guest that thinks the UN can administer post-war Gaza. I'm going to be speaking with your friend Jason Pack, who believes that Qatar needs to lead the charge along with a coalition of Arab states, Saudi Arabia, UAE, in a sort of multilateral coalition. And then I have other people that I've spoken with that just don't think either of those scenarios are going to happen, or that even Israel really wants to administer a post-war Gaza. Where do you stand on all of that? What's your take on what the future holds for a post-war Gaza?
Well, first of all, I think that the Israelis do not want to have to shoulder responsibility for the day-to-day administration of Gaza, which would not only involve the normal functions of government, but it would also involve restoring services that they destroyed, and an enormous reconstruction effort. That's not something the Israelis want to take on. The United States has made very clear that while it supports the notion of destroying Hamas, it does not want to see a reoccupation of Israel. Where the problem lies is that Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, has been quite vocal in recent days in terms of that he envisions a long-term, indefinite in his words, security presence of some kind in Gaza. Whether that means troops in Gaza, or whether that means that the Israelis can go in and out of Gaza at will to neutralize supposed threats. The basic issue with all of these proposals and ideas that are being floated around is that no party is going to get involved in the administration of Gaza that would succeed Hamas without it being very clearly linked to an Israeli-Palestinian, a credible Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And no party, or certainly not the Middle Eastern parties, whether that's Gulf states or whether that's Turkey, for example, or a combination of those, is going to want to enter Gaza and take responsibility with a wild card of an Israeli military presence or access in any form or fashion. So I think, you know, what everybody is focused on now, despite all the discussion, if you wish, about it, the day after, what everybody's focused now on is trying to get a ceasefire and trying to alleviate a horrendous humanitarian crisis. In some ways, how that ceasefire or humanitarian pauses, whatever that may be, is structured could influence what the day after is going to look like.
Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, for example, are you going to have external forces trying to guarantee the safety of humanitarian corridors? With other words, what happens on the ground in Gaza could well shape what happens afterwards.
With regards to the calls for a ceasefire, two developments that I've seen that I think are significant is Secretary of State Antony Blinken here in the U.S. saying there's been too many Palestinians killed. And then also we have the Prime Minister of France, Emmanuel Macron, essentially saying the bombing needs to stop. Do you think these developments are significant?
Well, first of all, what's too many? It's sort of a very a problematic statement. But the situation that you have is that neither Israel for sure, nor the United States wants Hamas to come out of this war in any form or fashion as victorious. The problem with that is that survival is victory for Hamas, which is the fundamental reason why the Israelis and why Netanyahu has rejected a ceasefire out of hand, and why the United States, while pushing for some sort of arrangement that's going to alleviate the humanitarian situation, has not pushed for a ceasefire until now. But at the same time, I think what you're seeing is that the continuous images coming out of Gaza, the rapidly deteriorating situation, for example, at medical facilities and hospitals, and public pressure essentially means that the United States is telling the Israelis, you don't have a lot of time. And so I think what you're seeing is mounting pressure on the Israelis. And the key, now in the case of France, do keep in mind that France voted in favor of the United Nations General Assembly meeting. So in fact, it voted against the United States. And what President Macron has said on Saturday to the BBC takes that a step further. He's demanded a ceasefire. And he's also very clearly said that there was no reason or legitimacy to continuously attack the civilian population in Gaza.
In regards to that UN General Assembly vote, I think it was pretty unanimous, that vote, except for, I think, the U.S., Israel, and then there was...
India.
Okay, okay.
There were about 15 votes against. Most or many of those votes were very smaller or very small states. And the U.S., Israel, India were obviously the major votes against.
Is there a significance to that?
I think that goes back to the issue that the United States raised there was that there was no mention of the October 7 Hamas attack, in which, you know, to be clear, Hamas brutally slaughtered what the Israelis now put at 1,200 mostly civilians. And now you can question whether the population in Gaza should be held hostage to mentioning that. But that was the major issue for the Americans.
So then with regards to the emergency meeting to discuss Israel's assault on Gaza, we had, you know, Arab leaders coming together in the Saudi capital of Riyadh. Can you let my listeners know what happened at this meeting and your analysis of it?
Well, what you had was an emergency meeting. The emergency obviously having evolved 35 days after the Israeli assault began. But it was an emergency meeting of both the Arab League, which has 22 members, and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which has 57 members, and which includes the 22 Arab states. And they had their summit yesterday in Riyadh, came out with a statement. From my perspective, what it did was the obvious, but it also put on display both the limited influence that Arab and Muslim states have in this conflict, and the divisions within the Arab and Muslim world, longstanding divisions that came out. So, with other words, the final declaration and the statements that were made by heads of government and heads of state attending the summit was obligatory, almost calls for a ceasefire, humanitarian aid, holding Israel accountable, release of the hostages. But there was no mechanism by which the Arab and Muslim states can get this enforced. What I think it was really about was to put pressure on the United States. Because if anyone, and the proof will be in the pudding, but if anyone can pressure the United States to halt or modify its military operations, it is the United States. There is no one else. Now, what I thought was really significant in many ways at the summit was the speech of the Iranian president.
Ibrahim Raisi, yes.
Ibrahim Raisi, who was for the first time in Saudi Arabia since the Chinese mediated a restoration of diplomatic relations in March of this year. And what Raisi said was basically annihilation of Israel, replace Israel with a Palestinian state from the river to the sea. He celebrated and glorified Hamas and Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed Lebanese Shiite militia. He called on those Muslim states, Arab states that have diplomatic relations with Israel to break off diplomatic relations. And he called for an economic and commercial boycott, which implicitly would theoretically would involve an oil boycott. Now, all of that is, first of all, the majority of the Arab and Muslim world, even if it has not formally recognized Israel, has kept the option of recognition of Israel on the table, contingent on a two-state solution. In other words, the creation of an independent Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel. In addition to that, certainly countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE find groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, they look at them as proxies of Iran, designed to interfere in the internal affairs of the Arab world. In fact, in my view, the Saudis and the Emiratis would like to see Hamas destroyed, even if they are taken aback by the brutality that Israel's applying to achieve that goal. That's Raisi's position isn't surprising. There are two things that are, well, one that's really surprising, but one thing that is, I think, important. The whole rapprochement within prior to the Gaza war, so improvement of relations of Iran with Saudi Arabia, with other Gulf states, with Egypt, as well as the improvement of relations that were strained between various Arab states, including Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Turkey, was premised on the expectation was that this would lead, that the focus would be on economic development, on economic relations, some degree of security discussions, and a moderation of positions so that you would not have stark differences. Raisi made clear that that is not the case. But having said all of that, the Iranians did not walk out of the summit, nor have they said anything about the fact that the summit, in the name of the summit and all of its attendees, reiterated those two-state solution as the solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
If I could ask you, with regards to the question of Iran and its backing of, say Hezbollah, I've had people on that say that there is a relationship, but sometimes they think that proxy may be the wrong word for it, that it's not, that their relationship is kind of informal in some ways. They get backing, but they're not simply puppets of Iran. Do you agree with that analysis? Do you disagree with it? What's your analysis of the relationship between Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, et cetera?
I think the relationship between Hamas and Iran and Hezbollah Iran are different relationships. Now, having said that, I don't use the word proxy when I either speak about the issue or write about the issue. I don't think that these are Simon Says relationships. So Tehran says Nasrallah of Hezbollah marches or Hamas watch marches. These are groups that are heavily backed by Iran, but have their own interests. Those interests may often coincide with Iran's interests. So, with other words, Hezbollah has an interest in not expanding the war that's going on now, but for different reasons than why Iran doesn't want those. That Iran doesn't want the war to expand. At the same time, I think that the Hamas attack on October 7 and what's followed subsequently was a mixed bag for Iran and for Hezbollah. It put both of them in a very difficult position because both of them are advocates of armed struggle against Israel, of resistance to the Israeli occupation, yet both of them have reasons not to go to war with Israel at this point. And Hamas puts them in the difficult position in which they have to balance being seen as being supportive of Hamas while at the same time ensuring that that doesn't spin out of control.
What can you say about Erdogan's participation at this summit?
Erdogan, in some ways, has come closest to the Iranian position. Turkey is the only other Middle Eastern state alongside Jordan, but Jordan, in a sense, is a special case because half of its population is of Palestinian descent. It long governed the West Bank, and it still is the guardian of the holy places in Jerusalem. So it's in a very different position from any other Arab or Muslim state, for that matter. But Turkey has come the closest. It's essentially ruptured its relationship with Israel by increasingly aggressive rhetoric on the part of the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who in fact, a little while ago, described Hamas as a liberation movement. But it's come closest to the Iranian position in the sense that Turkey has withdrawn its ambassador. It suspended energy talks with Israel. There are calls for an economic or commercial boycott. So in that sense, the Turks are the ones that have really done something. Whether, you know, leave aside what effect that has and what impact it has, but that they came the closest. But again, they were if I'm not incorrect, in fact, the first Muslim state to ever recognize Israel. They've never questioned as such Israel's existence. So the issue of one or two states isn't an issue to them.
I also wanted to ask you about, in your latest piece on your website, you talk a little bit about the Beirut-based Hamas Political Bureau member, Osama Hamdan, who was recently interviewed by Al Jazeera. What did you feel was important about his interview in Al Jazeera in relation to what we have seen at the summit?
Well, I think he did what the Iranians were doing on the one hand, which is basically say, we want actions. We don't need speeches. And of course, what the Riyadh summit was, it was speeches and a statement. But on the other hand, he was much more in line with, let's say, the mainstream opinion, in that the reason he wanted action was because that is what would persuade the United States to twist Israel's arm.
So then, with regards to this summit, it sounds like one of the big takeaways that you have from it is that really these Arab states may not have much influence on being able to rein in what Israel is doing in Gaza, and in a way, it's going to be the Western nations that do that.
Well, to be fair, the international community, doesn't matter who, including China, are not going to be the ones who are going to be able to either exert the necessary pressure or negotiate an end to the fighting. Now, in the case of China, for example, there is a niche for them, whereas their influence is not in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or in Gaza. They do have a degree of influence in Tehran. And so they do have a role in trying to prevent the Gaza war from expanding. The point here being that there are very few states that can play a role, and you can count them on one hand.
So the U.S., China, what other states do you think will play a role, well, or could play a role?
Primarily the United States, Qatar, Egypt, and Turkey. So the United States is the country that has influence in Israel, obviously has no influence with Hamas, but Qatar does and has played a significant role in release of hostages until now and is involved in trying to get more hostages released. Egypt plays a role, because it does, well, it borders on Gaza alongside Israel. And therefore, it does deal with Hamas. And it does have influence with Hamas. And Turkey, of course, has relations with Hamas. But so far, it's really not been a player in this.
You also mentioned that another focal point is U.S. President Joe Biden's meeting on Monday with his Indonesian counterpart, Joko, I don't want to mispronounce, Widodo?
Widodo.
Why is that a focal point? If you could elaborate on that.
Well, first of all, Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim majority state. And it's also the world's largest Muslim majority democracy. And so it does carry weight. And if you're looking at potential countries that could play a role in the day after the guns fall silent, then Indonesia would probably be a party that's acceptable to both Israel and the Palestinians. More immediately, Widodo was at the summit in Riyadh. And if the summit was, and the statement that was issued was geared towards increasing pressure on the United States to pressure Israel, then this is going to be the first face-to-face meeting of Biden with a Muslim leader. And Widodo's in or on his way to Washington at the moment, in advance of the Asian Pacific Economic Summit that is taking place in San Francisco this week.
There's also going to be another council meeting coming up in the next few days, right, that you spoke about?
Indeed. The security, one of the frustrations that you did hear at the Riyadh summit was, on the one hand, the hypocrisy of Western states, which undermines their credibility in terms of
double standards, right?
Double standards opposing the a ceasefire or sanctioning Russia for the very same things that Israel is doing. Now, to be fair, there's a degree of hypocrisy on the Arab and Muslim side too, because present at the summit in Riyadh was Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian leader, who used the very same tactics in a decade-long civil war that only recently ended in Syria. But having said all of that, the other element here is the fact that the United Nations Security Council, 35, 36, 37 days, whatever it is now, into the war in Gaza, has been incapable of passing a resolution. So you now have a draft resolution that's being circulated by Malta which actually has within the Security Council at the moment the children's portfolio, and the United Arab Emirates, which is designed to try and tackle the issue of a ceasefire in a way that they may get a majority vote and no vetoes on it. And that is by focusing on children who seemingly account for half of all the casualties in Gaza, and trying to find creative language without using the word ceasefire, but creative enough for a country like Russia to accept it. And there's talk of a long-term truce, a long-term halt to the fighting, various formulations of this. I think the interesting thing here is that China is the chair this month of the United Nations Security Council, and it would like to see its chairmanship being successful and victorious, and a UN a Security Council resolution on Gaza would constitute that. Now, the other interesting part of this is that to try and compensate, if you wish, for the weakness of the Arab and Muslim world in contributing to achieving a ceasefire, the Saudi foreign minister yesterday at a news conference after the summit basically said, if we don't get our act together, if the international community does not get its act together to achieve a halt to the fighting in Gaza, then we need to think the nature of the current international security order, because it all either has to work for all or it doesn't work. So, you know, that was his way of trying to give the statement some heft.
What do you think the implications of all this is when it comes to relationships between, say, the U.S. and Arab states? Do you think this is going to have any long-term ramifications?
I think it will. Obviously, I mean, at this point, U.S. credibility, or for that matter, European credibility, is not very high in the Middle East and the Muslim world. Now, how much damage it will do is going to depend a lot on how the war in Gaza evolves. With other words, what exactly the U.S. role will be in bringing in silencing the guns, and what the U.S. position and role will be in terms of the arrangements the day after. And those arrangements do not involve not just the daily administration of Gaza, but moving to a credible process to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Since you mentioned Bashar al-Assad, so he was welcomed back into the Arab League after basically years of being absent, you know, Syria not being involved. I think they were suspended, but he was let back in, I think, back in May. What's the significance of Assad's return to the Arab fold? Because, you know, for years he wasn't really involved, and I think this says something that there's been a rehabilitation of Assad.
Well, I think the rehabilitation had to do with two things. One was that the region as such, and this is prior to the Gaza war, the region as such was moving towards de-escalation of conflicts and disputes. And the notion was, and Gaza presumably put an end to that, but the notion was that you can just simply freeze disputes and conflicts, and you can focus on economic cooperation, on trade. And, you know, those conflicts just will remain in the icebox. And so as part of that process, Assad was brought into returned to the Arab fold, from which he had been excluded early on in 2011, early on in the Syrian civil war. Now, it was also a recognition that various Gulf states, who in various different forms, various Arab states, had supported the rebels against Bashar al-Assad, because the initial, certainly of the Saudis, for example, the initial feeling was that Bashar al-Assad was Iran's friend. So getting rid of Bashar al-Assad was a good thing. But fact of the matter is, Bashar al-Assad, with Russian and Iranian support, effectively won the civil war. And the efforts to remove him failed. And at the same time, you had an enormous number of Syrian refugees who had fled the war, who host countries, including Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, would prefer to see returned to Syria. You had a drug smuggling problem with the Syrian government being involved in the trade of Captagon that was being smuggled into Gulf states and into Jordan and elsewhere. And there was the notion, well, if we can't expel Bashar al-Assad by supporting the rebels, maybe we can do that by engaging with him, including economically. None of that has worked. Refugees are not returning in great numbers, at least not voluntarily. The drug trade continues unabated. And breaking the relationship with Iran is going to be very difficult, all the more so because the U.S. sanctions on Syria make it difficult to invest in Syria.
I'm curious, what is your analysis of how has Assad been able to survive for so long? And does his survival have any implications for regards to things like U.S. policy in the Middle East, how Arab states work with other Arab states and other related issues?
Well, I think that the issue of Bashar al-Assad does have some degree of popular support, particularly among minorities. First and foremost, his own minority, the Alawites, but also other minorities who fear that if Sunni Muslims were to come to power, there may be a great deal of vengeance that takes place. So, you know, let me put it differently. There certainly is support for the regime, even if presumably within certain quarters within the regime, there may be those who feel it's time for Bashar al-Assad to go.
I was going to say real quick in that regard, one thing I've always heard is that there are elements of Syrian society that may not like Assad, but they're afraid of some of the alternatives. So like Absolutely. You said, the Sunni Muslim. So that is something that should be of concern to Alawites, et cetera. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. So that's one factor. The other factor is that, you know, look, the United States hasn't been all that successful at regime change, certainly not at regime change in the Middle East. And clearly, Middle Easterners are no better at it, if you wish. You know, the issue, of course, is that at the end of the day, the winner in Assad's return to the Arab fold is Assad. You know, the Arab states, or certainly the Gulf states, and particularly Saudi Arabia, the UAE, haven't gotten very much, and they don't have a lot to show for themselves.
In regards to, I think, this idea of eradicating Hamas, I've had some guests on the show recently who think that's a very abstract notion and they don't know what that means. I mean, does it mean eliminating their military capabilities? Does it mean eliminating Hamas totally? I've had some guests say that they think it's a very grandiose ambition. I've seen some concern that even if you were to get rid of Hamas, you'll have other militant Palestinian resistance groups fill the vacuum. Do you think these concerns are valid?
Look, I think at this point, there's a lot of speculation. What the Israelis certainly want is to deprive Hamas of its military capabilities, to dismantle those, destroy those, and ensure that it can't rebuild those. And if at least some Israelis, including Netanyahu, for the longest period of time found Hamas government in Gaza convenient because it kept the Palestinian polity divided.
Yeah, I was going to say the famous Netanyahu line, I think, was we control the height of the flame in Gaza. It sounds like the belief was that Hamas could be contained.
Well, it was not so much an issue of being contained, but it was of a divided Palestinian polity not being able to negotiate the final resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I think today the question of Hamas being in government, even if it were a demilitarized Hamas, is no longer an option for Israel. Now, interestingly enough, let me just take a step back. What Hamas's future is, we don't know. There are people, and I think that's correct, who say, sure, you can physically eliminate it at a price, if you're willing to pay that price. And Israel seemingly is. But you can't kill the idea. Now, the problem with that statement is, what is the idea? With other words, does a majority of Palestinians buy into Hamas's ideology, or is it what they buy into, a liberation or a resistance against occupation and a liberation struggle that leads to an independent national existence? Possibly, and most in majority, most Palestinians today would probably agree that it would be alongside Israel, not in the place of Israel. So, you know, that idea of Hamas as an idea is problematic. We also have no idea what the impact of the Gaza war is on Hamas's popularity. Certainly, we have no idea of what it is in Gaza. There are indications in the West Bank that Hamas's prestige has been enhanced by the fact that it is fighting the Israelis. In Gaza, who knows? I mean, you know, the logical conclusion may be that people blame Hamas for having brought on the destruction. But we don't know if that's the case. I mean, this today, you have a generation in Gaza that's very bitter and very angry. And that anger is, at the moment at least, for primarily against Israel, not against Hamas. If you think back, the only corollary I can think of, which is what the public opinion or the impact on public opinion is of sanctions. In many cases, look at Iraq. It was rallying around the flag. So we really, I mean, a lot of people make a lot of statements. And we don't know. So if indeed the Israelis were to succeed in physically eliminating Hamas? Who's going to rule Gaza? Interestingly enough, Netanyahu yesterday ruled out what was probably the most popular option, at least popular in among governments and in political circles, which was that the Palestine Authority of President Mahmoud Abbas would take control of Gaza. And Abbas has made very clear that he would only do that if it were linked to a credible peace process. And I don't think a credible peace process is possible with the current Israeli government. Interestingly enough, in the news conference that Netanyahu gave yesterday, he ruled out the Palestine Authority as a successor to Hamas, which, if you're looking for a Palestinian option, really only leaves you with what some people call a homegrown Palestinian leadership. And it's certainly not clear who that would be. It's certainly not certain that anyone would want to come to office in Gaza on the back of an Israeli tank. And again, it would then, the only way to do that would be a credible link to a credible peace process. Now, one speculation, and this is speculation on my part, and I have nothing factual to base it on. But I did think it was very interesting when the Qatari Emir Tamimi went on his recent Middle East tour, in which he was in Egypt, and then at the summit in Riyadh. But his first stop was the United Arab Emirates. And the question is why? I mean, the relationship between the UAE and Qatar is a very complex relationship. My speculation, and again, it's speculation, is that the UAE has long wanted to see Mohammed Dahlan, a former Gaza security chief for Fatah, who is an Abu Dhabi-based businessman who does a fair amount of back-channeling for the Emirati president, Mohammed bin Zayed, and who hasn't put himself forward, but has tried in recent weeks to put himself back in the limelight, that may have been a point of discussion between the Qataris and the Emiratis, because the Qataris don't have anyone with any stature, any Palestinian with any stature who could fulfill that role. But again, I don't think that the UAE would want to be associated with any attempt to impose a government on Gaza without that being linked to a credible peace process.
If we could go back to Hamas for a second, I agree with you that there is something problematic about saying Hamas is an idea. I think the idea is, to me, I would say the idea is militant Palestinian resistance is the idea that I don't think is going to die until there's a resolution to the Israel-Palestine issue. That's my personal view. I don't think Hamas itself is the idea, and I think it's a misnomer to say that because, I mean, Hamas is the government of Gaza. And I think that's another issue that comes up is, you know, there's a lot of people in Gaza that are hired as civil servants, and that's administered by Hamas. So do you think there's sometimes a misunderstanding of the relationship between the Gazan people and Hamas? Because I'm not sure every civil servant or someone that's hired as a teacher in Gaza by Hamas is necessarily, in ideological lockstep with Hamas. Does that make sense?
Hamas has always presented itself as a resistance movement. It's not presented itself as a government. But fact of the matter is that in 2007, when it kicked al-Fatah, the party that is dominant in the West Bank and in the Palestine Authority, when it kicked al-Fatah out of Gaza, it took control of the administration of Gaza. And, you know, the Israelis are right in a sense when they try and undermine claims of casualties made by the Gaza Health Ministry, saying that's Hamas. Of course it's Hamas, because Hamas was the government. It, you know, it ran the government's offices, and it was responsible for the delivery of public services and goods. And that included health. Now, does that mean that every government employee is a Hamas activist or a Hamas member? No. But clearly, senior positions throughout the government in Gaza would have been occupied by Hamas. So, but Hamas, you know, the aura it wants is the aura of a resistance movement, not the aura of a government. I think when we talk about the Hamas ideology and what will resonate with any Palestinian is the struggle for national independence. This Israeli government will certainly have fed the notion that at this point there's nothing to talk about, and that therefore militancy is the only option that Palestinians have. Whether that is the notion that comes out of this war remains to be seen. It could well be, but I think that, you know, at the core, despite its inspiration that it gets from the Muslim Brotherhood, despite the Islamist nature of the movement, fundamentally, Hamas is a nationalist movement. And that sense of nationalism is what resonates.
I just had one or two more questions here. I wanted to talk a little bit about Netanyahu, because I feel like it's really key to understand the role Netanyahu has played in Israel and with regards to the policies towards Gaza and the West Bank and the actions his government has taken over the past few years. How important is it to take a hard look at the sort of fruits born of Netanyahu's governance?
Well, look, first of all, I think Netanyahu's days are numbered. You know, he is no longer a long-term player. His popularity is rock-bottomed. He's held responsible for the breakdown on October 7th, the fact that this was an Israeli intelligence and operational failure, even though he's tried to put the blame on everybody else but himself. And so the question is not when he will be forced to resign. If he will be forced to resign, the question is when he will be forced to resign. It's unlikely that that's going to happen as long as the war continues. But the knives will be on the table the moment the guns fall silent. And of course, you're going to get an investigation out of which Netanyahu is not going to emerge in a necessarily positive light. Now, I think there's also a difference. While Netanyahu systematically throughout the 14 years in which he was mostly the head of government, prime minister, has worked hard to thwart the possibility of a two-state solution. But even so, there is a distinction between this government and past governments. This government is the most far-right, most ultra-nationalist, most ultra-conservative government that Israel has ever known. And its actions have been far more provocative than we've seen by past governments. I think one's got to be careful in assuming, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, the breather once Trump lost the US election in 2020. It could only get better. And I think there's a sense of that with Netanyahu too. But fundamentally, they may disagree in style and in tactics, but fundamentally, someone like Benny Gantz isn't all that different from Netanyahu. It's not like Benny Gantz is going to come to office, immediately recognize a two-state solution, and actually take real steps to try and achieve it.
I'm curious because I've had a lot of people bring this up with regards to the farthest ends of the far right in Israel. So these figures like the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, or the national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, are these people just going to end up being out of the picture completely at some point? Because I've had people say to me that, well, they're so embedded now, and they have their tendrils into the sort of political milieu in Israel, that they're not just going to go away. But then other people have said to me, no, the far right in Israel is going to just collapse after this war is over. I don't want to get too speculative, but where do you see things headed for the sort of even right of the Likud party elements of Israeli political society?
Well, I think, first of all, Israel as such, in terms of public opinion, over the years has moved to the right. There were many Israelis who, even if they favored a two-state solution, believed that the status quo was feasible and viable because there was no counterpart for whatever reason they would cite. So I think that's a real move to the right. But Israel today is a very polarized society. And we saw that with the protests against the judicial reforms, which were massive. The ultra-religious segment of Israel is the fastest growing segment. They have the highest birth rates. You've seen that shift in towards the right in the Israeli military. There was a Colonel Winter a number of years ago who was a major Israeli military commander, who essentially distributed far-right texts in advance of Israeli military engagements. You've got separate units for ultra-conservative Jews. So yes, I mean, you know, they have roots in Israeli society. I'm not going to put percentages on it, and we'll see what the chips are, what happens when the chips are down, and there is a real possibility for a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, what people will choose. But I think it's too simple to say, well, these guys had their time in government and they're just going to sort of take off into the desert and disappear once they're out of office.
You mentioned the explosion in population of, the sort of ultra-religious Jewish population in Israel. One thing that has come across my radar occasionally, but I wouldn't say I'm an expert on it, is this issue of the Haredim. And I believe their employment numbers are quite low compared to the non-Haredi Jewish men. So I'm looking at the Times of Israel. It says, Haredim work less, just 51% of Haredi men are employed compared to 86% among non-Haredi Jewish men. Is this a problem? Because I've heard people say this actually presents a huge problem for Israel, a sort of segment of the population that doesn't want to serve in the IDF and isn't really interested in necessarily providing to the economy. Do you think that's overplayed or underplayed?
Look, one element of Israel's always been governed by coalitions, never by one party. One element of whatever coalition agreement there was, whether that was with Labor in government or whether that was with Likud in government or in the brief periods where others were in government. But one element of every coalition agreement was concessions to the religious, which included exemption from the military if they were engaged in full-time religious study in yeshivas, religious seminaries. I think one thing that is, one of the changes that is taking place is that there is a segment of Haredi youth that don't quite want that lifestyle anymore. They want to be productive. They want to have opportunity in the labor market. And so yes, there is, the fact is that there is far lower employment in male, there's far less male employment among the Haredim. Let's not even talk about women and women employment. But there are also trends and pushes to try and change that and the coming out of the community itself.
Yeah, I think there's a push to get a lot of Haredi men involved in the tech center. I want to reiterate, because I think I misspoke earlier. It's 51% of Haredi men are employed. I hope I didn't say unemployed, but you continue with what you were saying.
Yeah, I don't have the figures offhand.
Yeah.
But there is no question that employment among the Haredim, male and female, is far lower than the national average.
Is that destabilizing in any way to Israeli society?
Well, I think of course, there's an economic side to this because this costs money. You have a significant unproductive segment of society. And increasingly, certainly secular Israelis are increasingly less willing to fund it and feel that the Haredim are who they are, but they need to pull their weight and should have the same rights and duties as any other Israeli has. And in the polarization in Israel, that's only going to get stronger.
Before we close out, I'm curious, I've had people say to me they've never seen anything like this in the past few years with regards to protests in the Arab and Muslim world with regards to the bombing of Gaza and the sort of level of rage that exists in parts of the Arab and Muslim world is very high right now. And I think in the U.S. we're also seeing what is really becoming a culture war between left and right over this issue. How much do you think those two issues are important, the sort of explosion of just anger in the Muslim and Arab world, and also how this is turning into a culture war issue in the U.S.?
Well, I think those are separate issues, to be fair. Whether these are, this is the highest level of anger, I'm not sure. It's a very high level of anger. There's no question about it, and I don't want to diminish it in any form or fashion. but there was a high level of anger about Iraq in 2003. There was a high level of anger in 67. And there was a high level of anger about Lebanon. Now, I haven't sat down and compared numbers and what have you, but you know, this is not the first time that there's a lot of public anger. I think the problem with it is, and you saw that in Egypt, is that that anger then translates into anger against the regime. And that's the real problem for Arab autocrats. I mean, you probably know, have a great better feel than I do for what's happening in the United States. But what I see is, you know, it's a very dangerous form of polarization. You know, the Israelis very successfully, also in Europe, but certainly in the United States, were able to get acceptance of the definition that anti-Zionism or criticism of Israel equals anti-Semitism. And as a result, you're seeing that on U.S. campuses, you're seeing that in reporting in the U.S. media, you're seeing that contractual arrangements that have been legalized in various U.S. states where, you know, for an advertisement or for whatever it may be, you have to sign that you're not going to boycott Israel. You know, it's so you can't criticize a black state in Africa because they're, you know, that would be anti-black racism. That's sort of the equivalent of it. And I think that that is a really very dangerous trend. You know, there probably is greater division in the United States than perhaps in Europe among the public in terms of support for Palestine versus support for Israel. But nonetheless, those are issues that should be able to be freely debated. And the price, you know, that this polarization is really the price of compromising fundamental freedoms.
In that regard, I was going to ask, do you think the level of anger in the U.S. populace, especially amongst young people, do you think this will have an effect on maybe the way Democrats approach this issue? Because I was just watching a, I think it was like a town hall meeting with Joe Biden, and a woman yelled out, she was yelling at Biden about the, what she called the genocide of Gaza. And there were people booing her, and Biden sort of had to say, let her speak, let her have her say. I feel like Democrats are trying to walk a tightrope right now. Do you think that could affect policy in the future?
Well, I think Democrats are split. You know, there's obviously the more progressive part of the Democratic Party that is much more critical of Israel. But look at the vote in Congress, in the House, in the first vote under the new speaker. That was overwhelmingly in support of Israel. And you saw someone like Rashid Tlaib being censored. Now, to be fair, her language was unfortunate. You know, she certainly used language that could be interpreted in different ways. You know, it's the nature of the beast at the moment that language matters. But nonetheless, the Democratic Party overwhelmingly voted in favor of that. I think at the grassroots, it's a different story. And, you know, there's a lot of talk, which I've seen, and again, you know this probably better than I do, about Biden having lost the Arab and Muslim vote. Frankly, the Arabs and Muslims as such, just like the Jews for that matter, don't have the votes to swing the election. Arabs and Muslims do have votes, significant votes, in crucial swing states. And that's why it matters. And as much as they may be disgusted, angry, whatever it may be, at Biden's support for Israel, Trump has said he would deport them. So I'm not sure they have really a place to go.
Since you mentioned the Rashida Tlaib thing, what would your advice be to people that are, I guess, focused on this issue now of whether or not people should use the term from the river to the sea? Because the reason I ask this is I do see the interpretation of it as a call for genocide. I've also broken bread with a lot of Palestinian activists who I sincerely believe think that it just means a one-state solution. So how would you say people may need to be looking at this slogan?
Well, let me say two things. I don't think one should be intimidated and allow oneself to be intimidated. I think one needs to stand one's ground and say whatever it is one wants to say. I certainly don't allow myself to be intimidated, but I also am careful not to use inflammatory language on either side of the divide because it doesn't serve a purpose. So I don't use a lot of adjectives. You know, let people decide for themselves what it is. I don't see any point in that. Now, having said that, let's keep in mind that the notion from a river to the sea implies two things. One, there's a history. You know, this goes back to 1967, to the Palestine Liberation Organization before Yasser Arafat took control. And I forget what the name of the then chairman of the PLO was, but he was famous for his use of the term from the river to the sea. And what he meant with that was that Palestinians would take, again, full control of the land between the Mediterranean and the Jordanian River, and a majority of Israeli Jews, would be returned to their homelands, whatever that may be. So if they were immigrants from country X, that's where they would be returned to. It then took on a slightly different notion with the rise of Yasser Arafat and the notion of a secular democratic state, which essentially nobody, certainly not Israelis, certainly not Jews, certainly not Westerners, believed was going to be a one state in the form and fashion that a one state is now being discussed. So there's a lot of connotation to this phrase, the river and the sea, and it may very well be. I mean, you know, nothing is static or frozen in time, and it may very well be for a lot of people the phrase from the river to the sea has evolved to a one state in which Palestinians and Israelis would have equal rights, but it still has that it still has that notion. And the last thing I'll say on this is those that use the phrase of a river from the river to the sea in the sense of an equitable one state solution, by implication are saying one of two things. They're not in favor of a two state solution, or they don't believe that a two state solution is possible. In the first case, remnants of the original definition of what a river to the state means, from the sea to the river means, are there. In the second case, that's a question of judgment, whether a two-state solution is still possible or not.
I just wanted to add to that. I think also this slogan, there's variants of it that have been used by pro-Israel elements. So the Likud Charter, I believe in the 70s, said between the sea and the Jordan, there will only be Israeli sovereignty. So it's been used in a number of different ways over the years.
Yeah, but that leads you into a very different discussion.
Okay.
The Likud Charter, or the Likud map, indeed, is an Israeli state from the river to the sea. There's a very famous moment in the 1970s when Ezra Weitzman, this was after the 1977 visit to Jerusalem by Anwar Sadat. Ezra Weitzman was at the time the Minister of Defense in the Begin government, a Likud government. He was a former commander of the Israeli Air Force, who had somewhat moderated his views after his son, who was also an Air Force pilot, was killed in battle. And there's a famous moment where he stands in the front of the Likud map from the river to the sea, and he's asked about the Palestinian Charter, which at the time still was a charter for a secular democratic state, one state. And he said, "I can dream, they can dream." Yeah, so with other words, the whole debate about charters is fairly relative, if you wish, and is really part of the information war.
I was going to ask as well, with regards to all this talk about rhetoric and the rhetoric Tlaib has used, is there a double standard with how we look at rhetoric when it's used by the sort of Israeli side? What I mean by that is Netanyahu recently invoked the biblical story of Amalek in a way that I, when Palestinians say, well, why is no one focusing on this? That seems to be a very dangerous analogy to make. I sort of understand where they're coming from. What's your take on that?
Two things. One is that Hamas and Israel today are mirror images of one another. I mean, you can fall over all kinds of statements that Hamas makes in terms of there are no innocent civilians, they're all settlers. That's what the Israeli president said about Gaza. There are no innocent civilians, they're all Hamas. If they weren't Hamas, they would have revolted against Hamas. Clearly, that's not how it works. So I think at that level, you know, the problem is that you have outrageous statements being made by both sides. But there's something more to the Amalek notion. And that is, religious law shapes cultures. And we've all talked about the need for reform of Islam. But if you look at Jewish law, when it comes to dealing with minorities and the other, it's frozen in time. Islam governed for all of its, whatever it is, 1600 years of history. Israel didn't govern. And if you look at what Maimonides codified in terms of Jewish law, you know, so if you've ever asked yourself, if you look at the Israeli occupation, it is unnecessarily harsh. It is unnecessarily humiliating. It could handle this occupation in a different fashion. But what, and I'm not saying that that's their reference point. And I'm sure it's not the reference point for every Israeli soldier on the West Bank or in Gaza today. But it is wholly in line with what Jewish law says, It talks about humiliating the other. It talks about making life for the other wretched. And again, I'm not saying, sure, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, whoever, all of these people may very well be, and Netanyahu, may very well be aware of what Jewish law says. I'm not sure that a majority of those who implement it know what they're doing. But there is a culture there, which raises the fundamental issue, which is an issue that is particularly being raised by the world's largest Muslim society, Muslim civil society movement, and its most moderate, in which it is arguing and to a degree implementing reform of religious law, Muslim religious law, but at the same time saying other religions need to follow suit.
Is there anything else you want to say in closing? And what should people be watching out for right now in terms of where this is all headed?
I think we've covered it by and large in terms of watching out. I mean, I think it's a question of really very closely following developments. And on the basis of that, trying to draw conclusions. There are too many variables. But clearly, I think, you know, one thing to watch out is whether or not the pressure on Israel mounts and to what degree Israel will be able and to resist that pressure and what price it's willing to pay if a price is being put a price tag is being put on it, on defying what increasingly probably will be a consent that also includes the United States. Or a consensus.
I hope this isn't a dumb question, but I feel if I don't ask it, I'd be doing a disservice to my
listeners. Questions are usually the most difficult ones.
Well, okay, so this is for my listeners who are maybe neophytes to this subject, but they heard you say that, you know, the sort of autocrats in the Middle East may be a little bit unnerved or worried right now about their populations being very angry about what's happening in Gaza. And I've known people that when I bring that up to them, they'll say, well, they're autocrats. Won't they just crush any rebellions that happen? And I think a lot of Americans have the wrong idea about how things work. I mean, even if these are autocracies, they can get toppled when the people are angry enough.
Well, look, I'm not predicting that you're going to have mass anti-government protests that are going to topple regimes. I'm not saying that couldn't happen, but I think the way to look at this is to look at the second decade of the 21st century. 2011 kicked off with mass protests across the Middle East. Four long-term autocrats were removed from office. Now, fair enough, all four, Tunisia having taken some time, all four of those toppling of autocrats was rolled back by a counter-revolutionary movement, which was really led by the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. But fast forward to the end of the second decade of the 21st century, and again, four autocrats were toppled. You know, in 2011, it was Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, Yemen. 2019-2020, it was Algeria, it was Iraq, it was Lebanon, it was Sudan. Those revolts may very well have had the same fate as the 2011 revolts. We don't know, because in some ways things were frozen by the pandemic. So the notion, yes, there would be crackdowns. And yes, those crackdowns would be brutal. That's what happened in Syria. That's what happened in Yemen. And that's what happened in Libya. But even despite the crackdowns, you had those revolts. And they were initially successful. And I think that's something that autocrats are very concerned about.
Well, with that being said, I want to thank you again, James Dorsey, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work? And is there anything you want to plug? You've had some good shows lately. You interviewed Gershon Baskin, an Israeli negotiator. So you have a lot of great material coming out.
Well, thank you. All I can do is encourage people to subscribe to my newsletter and podcast, which they can do at www.jamesmdorsey.substack.com. And if I can add one more plug, I would appreciate if at least some subscribers would be willing to become voluntary paid subscribers. I have a large subscriber base. I very deliberately keep the distribution free because I want to have as wide a distribution as possible and as much of an impact as I can have. But it does cost money, and I'd like to be able to cover my costs. And so anyone who voluntarily would be willing to take out a paid subscription, I would be extremely grateful.
Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you'll check out James Dorsey's Turbulent World blog and his Substack. As always, if you appreciate the work here I do at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.